speakers. I didn't get to the Axis of the Evil Pirates of the Caribbean segment. I'll put that on tomorrow. Interview with a couple of chaps who talk about the long-standing ties between Venezuela and Iran, going back to the OPEC days when they were both founding members of OPEC, even though both countries were led by... one was the Peacock Prince, Peacock King, or Shah, and the ruling elite in Venezuela was pretty much in the U.S. pocket, but they still got uppity enough to collaborate on OPEC. That'll be tomorrow at 5. Labor hours at hand and ready to go, raring to go, and enjoy your Saturday afternoon. Remember, those of you who are not working, opinions are those of the speakers. Oh, one other thing, there's another round of airshifter orientation training coming up at the beginning of February. So if you want to pick up one of the spots or do some subbing or something, or just find out about the station, you can write airshifter training at weft.org to find out more about that.
Hello, folks. Welcome to the January 14th, 2012 edition of the Illinois World Labor Hour, brought to you over the air by WFT 90.1 FM radio in Champaign, Illinois, and webcast worldwide at WFT.org. The views and opinions expressed during this hour of programming, those of the speaker, and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of WFT's management, board of directors, or of Prairie Air Incorporated. Now, here's Tom to acknowledge some of our underwriters.
This hour of programming is brought to you in part by Jobs with Justice, a coalition of union and community groups working for economic justice and workers' rights. Jobs with Justice holds regular meetings on the third Saturday of every month. For more information or for the unemployed or underemployed helpline, call 217-469-6111. That's 469-6111. And this hour of programming is being brought to you by you listeners of WEFT and by the Brotherhood of the Maintenance of the Way. The Brotherhood of the Maintenance of the Way employees are proud to continue their support for the Illinois World Labor Hour. A democratic union, the BMWE, celebrates the voice for labor on WEFT. It is our hope that all workers may share the same benefits that we enjoy, such as living wages, job security, away-from-home expense pay, early retirement, Canadian-style health insurance, and guaranteed year-round work. And the Illinois World Labor Hour is supported in part by you listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois.
Okay, thank you, Tom. I'm your host, David Johnson, here today with co-host Tom Thomas, who will have some workers' interest news for us later in the show, and Labor Hour Cultural Corner. Tom's poem for this week in his book, Cries for Justice, is Remembering Martin, an ode to the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Also with us here today is Bob Pelesny and Bill Gorell, co-founder of the Illinois World Labor Hour. And we're going to have a special, our show's dedicated to the anniversary of the birth date of Dr. Martin Luther King. And we're going to have some interesting segments. I know a lot of people might be thinking, oh gosh, you know, I see so much of that around this time of year, around his birthday. But we're going to be talking about stuff you'll never hear or see on the corporate media about Dr. King. By the way, I just want to say, if you didn't get a chance to catch Higher Ground early this morning from 8 to 10, very, very excellent program. They had a tribute to Dr. Martin Luther King as well, including some real gem recordings of interviews done with Martin Luther King. Never knew they existed. And also, they played the Riverside speech in its entirety, which we're going to be talking about because, Dr. Martin Luther King had a lot of great speeches, particularly Been to the Mountaintop, and I've had a Dream, which you always hear in the corporate media every year around his birthday when they do tributes to him. However, the Riverside Church speech, Beyond Vietnam, is one that has been suppressed, and it's right up there in the top three of his great speeches, and we're going to be talking a little bit about segments from that. But anyway, here's Tom to kick off this week's edition of Workers' Interest News.
Urbana City Council members have given the preliminary okay to act as a conduit for grant money that would help Mervis Industries open a regional recycling center on the northern edge of the city. The property on North Cunningham Avenue has been awaiting development for 2 years since city officials gave the initial green light for the company to open the recycling center. But Mervis Industries would have to complete improvements to Cunningham Avenue in order to operate the facility. The company asked for city assistance with the project, and the city was notified in November that a state grant would be made available to help pay for up to 75% of the project, which would amount to $326,080. Mervis Industries would cover the remaining balance. Council members welcomed the development and the strategies to fund the project, reporting that the facility should be a boon to that area of the city, since it's going to bring revitalization to North Cunningham Avenue. They also praised the job-creating aspect of the project, expecting the project to provide employment for at least 10 people in the long run, as well as temporary jobs for construction of the facility. Bob?
All right, thanks, Tom. An audit released by Apple on Friday reveals widespread violation of worker rights and environmental practices by manufacturing partners for the company's widely popular iPhone, iPad, and other gadgets that they manufacture around the world. Apple found that 62% of the 229 facilities inspected were not in compliance with the company's maximum 60-hour work week policy.
Maximum 60-hour week, okay.
Yeah. But in 62,
compared to 80 or 100 hours?
Yeah, and 62% of their 229 facilities were not in compliance with that. So it's not just one or two. 13% also did not have adequate protections for juvenile workers, and 32% had problems with the management of hazardous waste. The audit released on Friday pointed to involuntary labor at 17 factories and underage labor at 5, according to the company's supplier responsibility report. Apple, which is based in Cupertino, California, also published the names of 156 companies that account for 97% of the company's procurement expenditures. Apple began releasing the report in 2007 and has faced scrutiny of labor practices at such manufacturers as Foxconn Technology Group. Apple's change of heart follows a highly publicized string of factory worker suicides in 2010 and deadly explosions in two Chinese factories in 2011. In its annual report, the company maintained that it is, quote, committed to driving the highest standards of social responsibility throughout our supply base and promoted its education and outreach programs that it hopes will reach the workers it indirectly employs through its contractors and subcontractors.
So, did you say involuntary labor in some of those plants?
That's what it says.
Slave labor?
No, that's what it says here. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, unbelievable. Involuntary labor at 17 factories and underage, you know. Yeah, it says that they're trying to require the suppliers to support the young people return to school. More than 93 factories where records indicated more than half the workers exceeded a limit of 60 hours in a work week.
Wow. Well, you know, that whole contractor-subcontractor system is the beast that these corporations have created, because I'll bet you one thing, what's going to happen is the corporations aren't going to pay for this. They're going to try to force their contractors and subcontractors to do it, which means they're going to be even further squeezed, and they're going to be, you know, trying to take it out, you know, further on their workers. It's a brutal, horrible system, you know.
Yeah.
Well, the main thing it does is they use it to absolve themselves of responsibility.
Absolutely. Absolutely, Bill.
Yes.
Prior to the 2003 invasion and occupation of Iraq, U.S. and other Western oil companies were all but completely shut out of Iraq's oil market, oil industry analyst Antonio Juhas told Al Jazeera. But thanks to the invasion and occupation, the companies are now back inside Iraq and producing oil there for the first time since being forced out of the country in 1973. Juhas explained that ExxonMobil, British Petroleum, and Shell were among the oil companies that played the most aggressive roles in lobbying their governments to ensure that the invasion would result in an Iraq open to foreign oil companies. It's also in this article, in a speech at Fort Bragg in the wake of the U.S. military withdrawal, U.S. President Barack Obama said that U.S. was leaving behind, quote, a sovereign, stable, and self-reliant Iraq with a representative government that was elected by its people. This prospect, Dr. Zaloum was blunt, an analyst. He said, quote, the last thing the U.S. cares about in the Middle East is democracy. It's about oil, full stop. And this is what we were saying all along back before the invasion and after the fact. So now you have it, folks. Regardless of their lies, both about why they invaded and also that there was a total withdrawal from Iraq. That is a big lie that's being perpetrated in corporate media. There's still troops there. Don't let them fool you.
About 30,000 of them, I've heard.
Yep. And there's a whole huge contingent just across the border in Kuwait, just in case the Iraqi people try to get a little too independent.
Yeah, according to U.S. Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack, the USDA will close 259 domestic offices, laboratories, and other facilities as part of an effort to save $150 million a year. While the closures and other cost-cutting steps will affect their headquarters in Washington, D.C., and their operations in 46 states, the savings will be relatively small in the context of the agency's $145 billion budget. The closures follow a review of USDA operations done as part of the Obama administration's efforts to cut waste, as they define it. The department has not provided details on which of the offices would be closed or exactly how many jobs would be lost, although some closures have already been announced. Deputy District Manager Andrew Lawrence from the department's office in Minneapolis said he was surprised the department was shutting down so many offices that handle food inspections, commenting they wiped out the entire Midwest. Those were not welcome words for a lot of people who are about to become jobless. Bob?
I got a story here out of Brazil. It says, answer an email from your employer after your workday is over and you're eligible for overtime pay, but only if you're a Brazilian citizen, that is. The worker-friendly amendment was added to the country's labor code and approved by Brazilian President Dilma Rousseff in December. The legislation says that company emails to workers are equivalent to orders given directly to the employee, the Associated Press reported. Labor attorneys told a newspaper, this makes it possible for workers answering emails after hours to ask for overtime pay. The law is the latest measure designed to address the serious implications of an increasingly 24/7 mobile workforce. It's also bound to make workers around the world more than a little jealous of their Brazilian peers. And this follows on German carmaker Volkswagen, which recently made headlines for its decision to shut off email to some employees 30 minutes after their shifts end. So, anyway, a little good news for Brazilian workers there.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. It seems like, you know, of all the, you know, problems going on in the world economy, you know, in North America and Europe, of course, Latin America, South America seems like they're doing pretty well, actually. And a lot of that has to do with the progressive pro-people governments that have come to power now over the years. And they're not tied into this whole World Bank, multinational, you know, international monetary
the
fund
IMF,
system.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay, significantly more Americans see very strong or strong class conflict between the rich and the poor, according to a survey released Wednesday by the Pew Research Center. The results show that Americans think that conflicts between the rich and poor are stronger than immigrant, native-born, black and white, or young and old. In 2009, 47% of respondents said they were very strong or strong. There were very strong or strong conflicts between the rich and the poor. But in 2011, 66%, up from 47%, saw the same. Same, possibly signaling that we are the 99% rhetoric of Occupy Wall Street has had an impact. The ongoing economic recession also may have magnified class differences. Income inequality has risen. The Pew survey found that whites had significantly larger increases in perception of class conflict than blacks and Hispanic, rising to 65% from 43% in 2009. 74% of African Americans and 61% of Hispanics see class conflicts increasingly by single digits. So it appears that blacks and Hispanics lot bigger percentages before saw class conflict were, you know, so their increases in seeing it increased a little bit because they're already pretty high where people of white ancestry, they're the ones that seem to be all of a sudden realizing there's class conflicts in the United States because it's probably affecting them directly. But anyway, the perception of class conflict has also intensified. 30% see very strong conflicts, a figure that doubled from 2009, making the largest increase since the question was first asked in 1987. And what's really interesting here is young people suffering the highest levels of unemployment see class conflicts significantly more than older people, with 71% of people aged 18 to 34 seeing very strong or strong class conflicts, while just 55% of people over 65 see them. Now, here's what's really interesting. Republicans see class conflict, and we're talking about rank and file voting Republicans here, not the politicians, okay? Republicans, people who identify themselves as voting Republicans, see class conflict less than Democrats and independents. However, still, 55% of people who identify themselves as voting Republican most or all the time see strong or very strong class conflicts in comparison to 73% of the Democrats and 68% of independents. But that's pretty significant. Over half of voting Republicans see strong or very strong class conflicts.
Yeah, and besides just the class conflict number, several of the topics there are related to, are economic and related to the class conflicts.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, folks, this is something that you just will not hear on mainstream media.
No.
I mean, they what class? We don't have any class in the United States. We're all middle class.
Yeah.
You know, and all the people that are on that TV set, they're probably making one hell of a lot more money than you make or what you will ever make in your life, and they probably think that they're middle class.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say a large number of them, especially on the big networks, they're definitely one percenters.
Oh, indeed. Tom?
Hey, the Champaign-Urbana Public Health District is offering free radon test kits while they last. The kits are available between 8 o'clock a.m. and noon and 1 p.m. to 4 p.m. weekdays at the district's Environmental Health Division at 201 West Kenyon Road in Champaign. Radon is a naturally occurring radioactive gas that enters buildings through cracks in the foundation, pipes, holes, or the water supply, and often accumulate to unsafe levels. It is odorless, colorless, and tasteless, and can only be detected with a test. Radon is the second leading cause of lung cancer in the United States and the top cause of lung cancer amongst non-smokers. It is responsible for more than 21,000 deaths in the U.S. every year. Nearly one in every 15 homes in the country is estimated to have elevated radon levels. Once again, the test kits are available for free between 8 a.m. and noon and between 1 p.m. and 4 p.m. weekdays at the district's Environmental Health Division at 201 West Kenyon Road in Champaign.
Thanks, Tom. I got a story here. It says home improvement retailer Home Depot said Thursday that it will hire 70,000 seasonal workers for the spring, its biggest season. And Lowe's is also announcing that they're going to hire more than 40,000 workers nationally. The hiring process will begin in earnest over the next several weeks based on the needs of individual stores and as mild weather approaches in the various markets, the company said. Both home improvement chains are looking for loaders, cashiers, garden center workers, stockers, and other support personnel. Last year, about half the seasonal workers were hired permanently as cashiers, sales, lot, and garden staffers. I guess Home Depot employs about 300,000 people nationally.
Wow. Okay. All right. You know, since we're doing a tribute to Martin Luther King today, we're going to be playing some music during the hour from that period. We're going to take a short musical break here with Marvin Gaye, and then we're going to be back with Tom Thomas's poem of the week. So stay tuned. You're listening to WFT 90.1 FM radio, and this is the Illinois World Labor Hour broadcasting from downtown Champaign, Illinois. We'll be right back.
There's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Yeah. Father, Father, we don't need to escalate. You see, war is not the answer, for only love can conquer hate. You know we've got to find a way to bring some love and here today. Oh, picket lines and picket signs, don't punish me with brutality. Sister, talk to me, sister, so you can see, sister, oh, what's going on, what's going on, what's going on, what's going on, yeah, what's going on.
Okay, we now come to the portion of our program with Tom Thomas's poem of the week, Remembering Martin.
On the fourth day of the fourth month of the year 1968, a champion of justice fell, a victim of ignorant hate. He had a dream those years ago he tried to spread throughout the land, a dream of peace and parity for which he chose to speak and stand. He spoke and stood in many towns and marched with sisters and brothers and spread his words of peace and love, inspiring many others. He taught equality was right, while all bigotry is evil. No matter the shade of the skin, each and all of us are equal. Yet for the wisdom that he taught, J. Edgar's sniper shot him down the day he was preparing to march with strikers in Memphis town. He had a dream that marches on four long decades after he fell. It's in sight, but we're not there yet, not until in unity we dwell. What it was that Martin died for, each one of us must remember, stand in solidarity, and our movements they can't dismember. Remembering Martin was written in January of 2007 at the Poets' Loft in Champaign, Illinois, in memory of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., who was murdered, many believe, by the FBI. Remembering Martin was brought to you today, January 14th, 2012, here on the Illinois World Labor Hour on WEFT 90.1 FM in Champaign, community radio for East Central Illinois.
Okay, thank you, Tom. Some public service announcements here. First of all, we want you to know that Neil Parthen's radio show, None Other Sports Show, is on today at 2 p.m. Is it every Saturday from 2 to 3. You can catch that on WRFU. You can just go online and pick it up WRFU.org, and that's Neil Parthen's Not Another Sports Show from 2 to 3 every Saturday. Also, Labor's View Worldview TV, which is this Sunday from 4 to 5 and every Sunday, is on Urbana Public Television, Comcast Channel 6. And this Sunday, the show will be showing clips of the film The Assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King, and with host Jim Iman and yours truly talking about the assassination conspiracy of the U.S. government against Martin Luther King Jr. Being complicit in his murder, and lots of documentation to prove this, in particular the King family, successful King family lawsuit against the U.S. government, and William Pepper, their attorney's book about this whole story. And last but not least, the Art Theater in downtown Champaign is becoming a consumer owner cooperative. For $65, you can be a co-owner of the share, and you can have a decision-making process in that, as far as determining what kind of movies are going to show, input into the operations, and also rental of the theater for different community organizations and stuff. So contact the Art Theater either in person or by phone to find out how you can become a member of the Art Theater Co-op. For just $65.
Oh, by the way, Dave, if anybody was listening to Focus 580 yesterday, they had Gar Alperovitz. That's Alperovitz, I believe. And he's written I can't remember the name of the book, but it has capitalism in the title. It's mainly about various types of enterprise ownership, including worker-owned cooperatives, and perhaps he would be interested in what's going on with the Art Theater now.
Oh, indeed, indeed.
And I'll look up the title for you.
Okay, go ahead, Bill. I'm just kind of queuing up something. Yeah, that would be really great.
Hey, Dave, if you would hand me the auxiliary cord, I do have something queued up here that's pretty good for today.
Okay.
It's called Whitey on the Moon.
Okay. Tell you what, we're going to go to a music break, and then we'll get that set up, Bill. So a little bit more period music here. And this is Illinois World Labor on WEFT.
Listen, baby. Ain't no mountain high. Ain't no valley low. Ain't no river wide enough, baby.
If you need me, call me. No matter where you are, no matter how far.
Don't worry, baby.
Just call my name. I'll be there in a hurry. You don't have to worry.
Oh, baby, there ain't no mountain high enough. Ain't no valley low enough. Ain't no river wide enough to keep me.
No wind.
A rat done bit my sister Nell with Whitey on the moon. Her face and arms began to swell, and Whitey's on the moon. I can't pay no doctor bills, but Whitey's on the moon. 10 years from now, I'll be paying still while Whitey's on the moon. You know, the man just upped my rent last night, cause Whitey's on the moon. No hot water, no toilets, no lights, but Whitey's on the moon. I wonder why he's upping me, cause Whitey's on the moon. Well, I was already giving him 50 a week, and now Whitey's on the moon. Taxes taking my whole damn check. The junkies make me a nervous wreck. The price of food is going up. And as if all that crap wasn't enough, a rat done bit my sister Nell with Whitey on the moon. Her face and arms began to swell, and Whitey's on the moon. Was all that money I made last year for Whitey on the moon? How come I ain't got no money here? Whitey's on the moon. You know, I just about had my bill of Whitey on the moon. I think I'll send these doctor bills, air mail special. To Whitey on the moon.
Okay, that was Compliments of Bill Gorell. That was Gil Scott-Heron. And, you know, I was a big fan of Gil Scott-Heron back in the, you know, 80s, and I'm not familiar with that song.
Yeah, I've always thought it was a pretty humorous song. And by the way, folks, I am really pro space exploration. I think we need a new planet, and we need to get on the ball, at the very least, put all our industry into orbit. Where actually it would be much more efficient, but that's another story. What I'm trying to do here is sort of move this Martin Luther King commemoration more, that a lot of people will, you know, the civil rights aspect of his life, and of course the anti-Vietnam War, which I think is where he really started freaking out the establishment.
Yes.
I don't think the corporate people minded giving black people jobs that much. It's just,
except in the South, but
yeah, but when it comes, I mean the true power elite.
Yes, yes.
You know, they would use
the 1%.
Yeah, they would use racism,
division.
You know, Richard Nixon and Kevin Phillips, by the way, has spent the rest of his life, I think, apologizing for the Southern strategy with all the books he's written that are real anti-Republican and even anti-capitalist.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, getting back to the point here, and that's why I wanted to play this. To bring it around to the economic aspects, which is the hugest impact really on almost any group, Northern Ireland. That was a big thing there. The Catholics were discriminated in terms of jobs, and they had such a dire economic straits. But that's why I wanted to bring this poem up rather than say the revolution will not be televised, which is another great one.
Yeah.
And also, too, by the way, I want to say Gar Alperovitz, the name of his book is Beyond Capitalism.
Okay.
And it's really interesting. It's about cooperatives. Carl Estabrook just called in about that. And, he said that he agreed, you know, thought it was a really important thing that Alperovitz is saying. Yeah, you know, these people aren't just going to give stuff to you.
Oh, heck no.
We're going to have to do it on our own.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and as Frederick Douglass said, you know, power concedes nothing without a demand.
Indeed.
But anyway, what we want to go to is this another speech by Martin Luther King, if I can find the right tab here. Here it is. And this one, Riverside Church speech against the Vietnam War, which is King stepping out of his place where he's supposed to be just looking after the interests of black people.
Stepping out of his place, when you say that, of course, you're stating the opinion of the 1%, the ruling class.
Yes, the ruling class.
Yeah, that's their opinion, yes.
Well, and that, and Dave, you know, at that time, that would have been the opinion of much more than one of the 1%, the ruling class.
Good point, Bill. I mean, because we got to remember,
including the people that raised me.
Yeah. Well, we got to remember too. We all grew up during this period. I mean, Tom's the eldest here, and then I think Bob, and then you're a year older than me, and I'm 54.
Okay.
So I remember this as a child. Martin Luther King was vilified in the media.
And I remember I lived out, you know, in B-Men, was raised there, and my only experience with black people would be coming into Champaign or Decatur with my parents. And, you know, and I remember the shoe shine stand that was here was up down the corner of Walnut and, that little street. There used to be a shoe shine stand in every downtown with black, with, I can't remember now. But, and I mean, things are so different now, and that's, Noam Chomsky kind of discusses this stuff. We get really bummed out about the way things are now. Mm-hmm. I mean, of course, racism still exists.
Yes.
And, you know, there may be something to the fact that all white people are racists.
And, I disagree, but
well,
anyway.
Sometimes in the way in the back of your, at least white people of say, our generation for sure.
I disagree, but anyway.
Maybe your daughter's generation.
Mm-hmm.
No, I do. I still, I will catch myself in not, you know, in my mind occasionally stereotyping.
Hmm. Okay. Well, anyway.
But it's just so deeply ingrained. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I don't know. Maybe all men are misogynist, too, at some point.
Let's not cut ourselves short here, Bill. Let's not overgeneralize too much, anyway. But anyway, you found this little gem here that I wasn't familiar with, and you want to share that
with
us?
Yeah, anyway, the Riverside speech was in April of 1967.
Uh-huh.
And this was to the Southern Christian Leadership Conference in Atlanta on August 16th, 1967. And what it is, it's where do we go from here? And it has a lot about the economic plight of African-Americans at that time.
Mm-hmm.
The very first paragraph kind of gets into a description of that, which we're all pretty familiar with. Also, he also does mention there were twice as many blacks dying in Vietnam as whites in proportion to their size in the population.
Mm-hmm.
And then he has a section called Depiction of Blackness and Negro Contributions, which is more of a cultural thing,
mm-hmm.
talking about how the word black is synonym for many bad things. You know, it's a metaphor for bad stuff. And then he starts getting into economics under a section called Basic Challenges, and I'll quote, "Another basic challenge is to discover how to organize our strength in terms of economic and political power." Now, the 1% was probably defecating in their pants as this was being said.
Mm-hmm.
"No one can deny that the Negro is in dire need of this kind of legitimate power. Indeed, one of the great problems that the Negro confronts is his lack of power. From old plantations in the South to newer ghettos of the North, the Negro has been confined to a life of voicelessness and powerlessness. Stripped of the right to make decisions concerning his life and destiny, he has been subject to the authoritarian and sometimes whimsical decisions of the white power structure. The plantation and ghetto were created by those who had power, both to confine those who had no power and to perpetuate their powerlessness. The problem of transforming the ghetto, therefore, is a problem of power confrontation of the forces of power demanding change and the forces of power dedicated to the preserving of the status quo. Now, power properly understood is nothing but the ability to achieve purpose. It is the strength required to bring about social, political, and economic change." And now, Dr. King, quotes a famous American socialist and unionist, quote, "Walter Reuther defined power one day. He said, 'Power is the ability of a labor union like the UAW to make the most powerful corporation in the world, General Motors, say yes when it wants to say no. That's power.'" And this is definitely a breakthrough in thinking, because if you really think about it, when you go to the civil rights movement, the memories of it are, especially with when you have talking about people like Martin Luther King rather than Malcolm X,
mm-hmm.
is that it's a big moral argument.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, we do that constantly. I mean, we do that in many spheres, and it is a good thing, but the only thing that it can do for you is to perhaps help you gain power,
mm-hmm.
which is really what you need, and it helps you gain power by getting people to sympathize with you.
But that alone will not do it, is what you're
right,
saying.
Right, that alone will not do it. For example, currently Occupy Wall Street
mm-hmm.
is is working greatly in the tradition of Dr. Martin Luther King and Gandhi.
Mm-hmm.
And they have gained a lot of support through all the video of cops beating them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And them taking it and not fighting back. Sometimes I really want them to fight back. You know?
Oh, but I know how you feel,
we would
Bill.
We have mass murders then.
However, but as one person I saw, a lawyers guild was giving a training in their nonviolent resistance, and he said, basically, just look at it like this. You're facing somebody that's got a helmet and a bunch of body armor on, plus a baton and mace and a taser and a gun. Who do you think's going to...
And he's a bigot.
Who do you think's going to win that battle?
Yeah, well, you remember the book... Steal This Book by Abbie Hoffman.
Right.
They had a section in there, appropriate dress to go to a demonstration.
Well, see, that's what I was
and
thinking.
That's the thing. I always think about that because these people go and confront these cops. They're not wearing anything. I mean, no helmet, no. I mean, occasionally you'll see somebody with a tear gas mask and that's it. You know, I mean, things start getting serious. People are going to have to wear appropriate clothing
to
defend themselves.
I do actually have a lot of the personal protective equipment from construction jobs to wear. I have a hard hat.
Yes.
I do need to get a face shield.
Yes.
But I do have a really good air filtration device that could filter out tear gas.
Okay. All right.
And but anyway, we're kind of stripping along here. But power, I mean, that's where you really start scaring people. That was what was scaring people with a lot of the more radical black nationalists and so on and so forth, where Martin Luther King was sort of used as the good cop and they were the bad cop.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, let's move on here. And again, like in the Riverside Church speech, he kind of beats up on Nietzsche a little bit because Nietzsche misinterprets the power of love.
Mm-hmm.
All right, because that's where their power is coming from. Okay, then he has a section called Developing a Program. And I'll quote now. We must develop a program that will drive the nation to a guaranteed annual income. I'm going to come out of this. A few years later, Richard Nixon, that was part of his platform was a guaranteed $5,000 a year annual income, and $5,000 a year in 1970 or 72 is pretty, not too bad. Now back to Martin Luther King. Quote, now early in this century, the proposal would have been greeted with ridicule and denunciation as destructive of initiative and responsibility. At that time, economic status was considered the measure of the individual's ability and talents. And in the thinking of that day, the absence of worldly goods indicated that a want of industrious habits and moral fiber. You know what? This guy reminds me of a recent statement by Herman Cain, where he said, if you aren't rich, it's your fault. You know? Now back to Martin Luther King, back to the sublime king from the ridiculous Cain.
Okay.
Quote, we've come a long way in our understanding of human motivation and of the blind operation of our economic system. I like that where he says there, the blind operation.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, because that is what a lot of conservatives, that's what they want. They don't want to have to try and make some kind of decision. Especially a moral decision. What they want to do is say, we have a system, and it's called capitalism, and it always goes towards equilibrium, and we have the invisible hand of the marketplace.
Mm-hmm.
But now back to Martin King. Now we realize that dislocations in the market operations of our economy and the prevalence of discrimination thrust people into idleness and bind them in constant or frequent unemployment against their will. Today, the poor are less often dismissed, I hope, from our consciences by being branded as inferior or incompetent. We also know that no matter how dynamically the economy develops and expands, it does not eliminate all poverty. And I think that's a really good point there.
Yes.
Economic growth in itself will not eliminate poverty. As we see now, our economy grows. But working people have not had a raise since 1970 in real dollars.
Mm-hmm. Real terms, yes.
Real mm-hmm. terms. And if you look at a chart, I saw these. I wish I knew where to tell you to look for them. A series of charts. One, it starts out with income and in the year 1900, a very nice steady arc up till 1970, then it goes flat.
Yes.
That's workers' income. But when you see the ones for productivity
and corporate profits,
profit and increase income of the wealthy,
yes,
those all they curve and then they start going straight up.
Yes.
At 1970, where the workers' incomes go flat.
Mm-hmm.
And but so that shows as itself, making a bigger pie doesn't mean that our piece gets any bigger.
Absolutely. You know, what's really haunting to me is when I listen, Higher Ground this morning played the entirety of the Riverside Church speech, and even though it's primarily about, anti-war speech about Vietnam, there's other issues touched on, of course. But what's haunting about it is that the same issues are here with us 45 years later. The same things Dr. King talked about in April of 1967, a year to the day before he was murdered, are still with us. The three evils of, let's see, what was it? Racism, materialism, and militarism.
That is correct. That's right. However, Whitey is not walking on the moon right now, though. Nobody is.
Nobody is.
Okay, let's see. The problem indicates that our emphasis must be twofold. We must create full employment or we must create incomes. People must be made consumers by one method or another. Once they are placed in this position, we need to be concerned that the potential of the individual is not wasted. New forms of work that enhance the social good will have to be devised for those for whom traditional jobs are not available. You know, that's all right there, man. That is real scary to the powers that be. Full employment. Well, there goes your mass army of the unemployed that keeps your wages down.
Yes. And the other thing I think that really scared the 1%, the ruling class at that time, was Dr. King's beginning of a poor people's campaign, and which, in fact, when he went to Memphis to support the striking sanitation workers, that was the kickoff to that program that they'd been planning, him and the other leadership in the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. And they were planning on having a march on Washington to shut down Washington, D.C., the nation's capital, until the powers that be relinquished and would start an actual full employment program and other programs to completely eliminate poverty. I think that and his opposition to the Vietnam War were the double things that they decided that they had to get rid of Dr. Martin Luther King.
Right. And also here in the next paragraph, he quotes a book by Henry George, who's somebody I've seen pop up a lot, and I really should read this guy. Something that Henry George wrote in a book called Progress and Poverty. Quote, "The fact is that the work which improves the condition of mankind, the work which extends knowledge and increases power and enriches literature and elevates thought, is not done to secure a living. It is not the work of slaves driven to their task by the taskmaster, or by animal necessity. It is the work of men who somehow find a form of work that brings a security for its own sake and a state of society where want is abolished." Well, this goes completely against the power structure.
Yes.
And it's sort of because work should only be for their profit.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it also kind of foreshadows the backlash politics that came up later and the famous Lewis Powell memo.
Mm-hmm.
Because all of the ferment in the late 60s, especially when it came to things like the anti-war movement and the environmental movement and so on and so forth, were pursued, and also the civil rights movement got a lot of help from the class that I'm talking about, were pursued by younger people who grew up in a fairly secure economy where people were not worried about getting a job,
mm-hmm.
where people had the extra time and the means to go out and be politically active. Right now, for me, from where I live, for me to come in and participate in political actions in Champaign cost me about $10 now.
Yeah.
And the Lewis Powell memo that I mentioned was written by Powell when he was still a lawyer before he became a Supreme Court justice.
Mm-hmm.
And it was sent to the president of the Chamber of Commerce, about how they really needed to step up and start a huge propaganda campaign and creating think tanks and publications and all the stuff that's been going on since the 1970s that brought us the Reagan Revolution and the last 30 years of ridiculous governance in this country.
Yeah, and regardless if it was a Republican or a Democrat in office, the Reagan principles of the change in our rulership, I mean, basically the policies and everything else the 1% pursuing hasn't changed. I mean, this is what Ronald Reagan ushered in, and it's still being, it was pursued by Bill Clinton as well, continuing to be pursued by Barack Obama, the same Reagan type neoliberal anti-worker principles. But anyway, gonna play a quick music break here, and we're gonna be right back. I want to talk a little bit while we still got some time about the King family wrongful death suit, about the U.S. government's conspiracy in the murder of Dr. Martin Luther King. A lot of you may be saying, oh, another conspiracy theory. No, this is fact. Stay tuned. Okay, folks, welcome back to the Illinois World Labor Hour, brought to you on the air by listener-supported community radio in East Central Illinois, WEFT. Just want to throw some fast facts at you in a little time we have here about Dr. Martin Luther King. The main point, I think, that we're trying to get through on the show is that you're going to see a lot of things about Dr. King here this weekend and on Monday. And the main thing is that the same powers that be that vilified Dr. King back in the day, back in the 60s, now after he was murdered, but his ideals lived on and even expanded, they couldn't kill that. They couldn't kill the dream. They couldn't kill the goal. So, of course, what's the famous slogan? I can't remember who said it, but it was basically, you know, when people are trying to create change, first the powers that be ignore you, then they ridicule you, then they attack you physically as well as intellectually, and then they basically give you what you want and say they were with you all along. Well, that's kind of what they did with the memory of Dr. King, is that they made him basically a martyr or a hero of him. But in the process, what they do is that they completely sterilize and sanitize his messages about class. I mean, Riverside, or anti-war for that matter. I mean, his Riverside church speech, I've never heard this played on the corporate media, and there's no mention of the Poor People's Campaign other than the context of that was maybe part of the furthering of the civil rights movement as far as race relations and that. But this was the thing, that the Poor People's Campaign was basically where Dr. King saw that they got quite a bit of progress done on the whole as far as the Voting Rights Act and the various things that were passed, the Civil Rights Act under Lyndon Johnson, but he saw that the problem was still there in the terms of income inequality and class, and this Poor People's Campaign was going to be a multiracial effort of poor people to demand changes in the system, and frankly, that's probably why he was murdered. But anyway, real quick here, some just interesting facts. As the leader of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, Dr. King maintained a policy of not publicly endorsing a U.S. political party or candidate. He says, I feel someone must remain in the position of non-alignment so that he can look objectively at both parties and be the conscience of both, not the servant or master of either. Okay, another interesting fact is the FBI, under written directive from Attorney General Robert Kennedy, began to telephone wiretaps of Dr. King in the fall of 1963. J. Edgar Hoover feared communists were trying to infiltrate the civil rights movement, but when no such evidence emerged, the Bureau used the incidental details called on tape over the next 5 years in attempts to force King out of the permanent leadership position in the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. to go on here, starting in 1965, Dr. King began to express doubts about the United States' role in the Vietnam War, which led to his Riverside Church. He basically opposed the Vietnam War besides moral reasons, the ground that the war took money and resources that could not be spent on social welfare services like the war on poverty, and that his famous quote, a nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense than on programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual death. Anyway.
Boy, that's some things.
Yeah, 45 years later, nothing has changed.
It's even much worse.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. King's opposition to the Vietnam War cost him significant support among many white liberal allies, including President Johnson and powerful publishers. The press, the U.S. press, began to viciously attack Dr. King. Life magazine called his Riverside speech demagogic slander that sounded like a script for Radio Hanoi. And the Washington Post declared that King had, quote, diminished his use to his cause, his country, and his people. I mean, how dare them? But anyway, nevertheless, and King began to speak.
Yeah, but you see, he's supposed to impress them.
Yeah.
You know, that's if he's not impressing the person who wrote that, well, then, yeah.
Yeah. And but anyway, on March 29, 1968, Dr. King went to Memphis, Tennessee in support of the striking sanitation workers represented by AFSCME Local 1733, who had been on strike since March 12th for higher wages and better treatment. And on April 3rd, King delivered his address to rally and delivered his I've Been to the Mountaintop address at Mason Temple. And, of course, the rest is history. He was murdered on the balcony of his motel room at the Lorraine Motel. The assassination of Dr. King led to nationwide wave of race riots in Washington, D.C., Chicago, Baltimore, Louisville, Kentucky, Kansas City, and dozens of other cities. But what was interesting, after the King's murder and the riots, the city of Memphis quickly settled the strike on terms favorable to the sanitation workers. Here we go. This is the real interesting part I got to squeeze in here. 2 months after King's death, escaped convict James Earl Ray was captured at London Heathrow Airport while trying to leave the United Kingdom on a false Canadian passport in the name of Ramon George Snide on his way to white-ruled Rhodesia at the time, which is now modern-day Zimbabwe.
Well, Dave, just how did this lone redneck pull all this off?
Well, that's what I'm getting to. Ray was quickly extradited to Tennessee in charge of King's murder. He confessed to the assassination on March 10th, though recanted his confession just 3 days later, saying that on the advice of his attorney at the time, Percy Forman, Ray pleaded guilty to avoid possible execution and instead received a 99-year sentence. Ray claimed that he met a man in Montreal, Canada, with the alias Raoul, who was involved in the assassination. Ray spent the rest of his life attempting unsuccessfully to withdraw his guilty plea and secure a trial he never had. Okay, on June 10th, 1977, shortly after Ray had testified to the House Committee of Assassinations that he did not shoot King. He and six other convicts escaped from Brushy Mountain State Penitentiary in Patros, Tennessee, and was quickly apprehended. It was interesting. I remember when this happened, and Jesse Jackson Jr. went on national television and said that, James Earl Ray, give yourself up, and that Jesse Jackson expressed the concern that the powers that be were going to use this opportunity to murder James Earl Ray. But anyway, what's interesting is James Earl Ray was a thief and a burglar. He had no record of committing any violent crime with a weapon, nor had he ever served in the military. So he really didn't have any, you know, skills with a weapon or any past MO, if you will. And two successive ballistic tests, while proving that the rifle similar to Ray's Remington Game Master had been the murder weapon, did not